You're listening to 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. On today's Open Source RVA, Richmond Macabre 2, More Nightmares from the River City. In this southern city of monuments, where the clatter of footsteps across ancient cobbles echo with hollow despair, terror is our constant companion. Phil Ford and Beth Brown, the editors of this second volume of Chilling Tales of Horror, talk about the book and why Richmond so readily lends itself as a backdrop to the grotesque and the unthinkable. And speaking of fiendish, sinister goings-on, we've reconvened our panel of politicos to visit perhaps the most haunted place in River City, 900 East Broad Street. Political strategist Paul Goldman, commentator Charlie Dirador, and former city councilman Bruce Tyler put the first month and a half of Mayor Dwight C. Jones' second term under the microscope. But first, some of the top headlines making news right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. The buzz over drones in Virginia shows no sign of fizzling out. Last week saw Charlottesville garnering national attention for being ostensibly the first town in the country to adopt an anti-drone resolution on Monday. Closely trailing that on Tuesday, the Virginia General Assembly approved a two-year moratorium on the use of drones by police and government agencies with considerable bipartisan support. This week, the Charlottesville-based civil liberties group, the Rutherford Institute, which is credited, along with anti-war activist David Swanson, for championing the drone banning legislation in their locality, is officially calling on Governor Bob McDonnell to approve the drone moratorium in spite of his previously voiced support of unmanned aerial vehicles. President of the Rutherford Institute, Attorney John Whitehead, warns that the urgency of formulating legislative safeguards to address the rapid, uncritical adoption of drone technology around the country cannot be understated. The Virginia state legislators at first proposed simply regulating the use of drones. The moratorium came about to allow more time to study the issue. It's week two, and the Richmond Police Department still has not responded to Open Source RVA's Freedom of Information Act request. Open Source first requested on January 22nd to find out how much the hiring of the Reed Smith law firm had so far cost taxpayers. The firm is handling a police civil suit against anarchist activists Mo Karn and Nathan Cox. Police legal counsel Victoria Benjamin partly responded to our request on January 30th, indicating that the firm was being paid at a rate of $330 per hour and had been engaged by the city on November 15th of last year. Benjamin declined to provide the full amount so far due to the firm, saying that the initial FOIA request did not seek the amount owed to Reed Smith, but instead asked for the total cost to taxpayers. She indicated that the follow-up would be treated as a second information request, but also indicated in an email response that, quote, in order to completely and properly respond without negatively impacting public safety and our intense operational responsibilities, the department is entitled to and elects to utilize 7 additional work days to respond. State law requires that in order to invoke the additional 7 days granted by the Act, that public bodies are to specify the conditions that make a response impossible. Open Source asked Benjamin on February 1st, 14 days ago, to specify how a routine Freedom of Information Act would negatively impact public safety. Benjamin has not responded to numerous emails and phone messages. In honor of Black History Month, Maymont is offering upstairs-downstairs tours of Maymont Mansion this month, including one on Saturday at 12:30 p.m. The tours will showcase the daily work and routine of the mansion's African-American domestic servants, with visits to the kitchen, butler's pantry, and other locations. Another tour will be given on Saturday, February 23rd. Admission is $3 for Maymont members and $5 for the general public, and you can get more information at maymont.org.
It seemed a bright start when on January 12th, Dwight C. Jones was sworn in for his second term as mayor of Richmond. But in the weeks leading up to that inaugural address, and in the month or so since, the Jones administration has grappled with a series of embarrassments and political difficulties beginning with the ouster of Deputy CAO Carolyn Graham amid scandal over allegations of mismanagement within the city's social services department, and culminating this week with the abrupt departure of Police Chief Brian Norwood, who brought a touch of glitzy Hollywood scandal to town. So what exactly is going on down at City Hall, and where does the buck stop? We've reconvened our panel of pundits and politicos to help us puzzle it all out. I'm with Charlie Dierdor, local businessman who now blogs about city issues at rvareport.com.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm with Bruce Tyler as well, former city councilman, a rare duck, the city Republican, and a principal with Baskerville Architects, Engineers, and Interior Designers.
Good evening.
Thanks for being here. And last but not least, Paul Goldman. He's former chairman of the Virginia Democratic Party and a contributor to both Fox News and Politico.com.
Good to be here.
Thank you for being here. So we're talking a little bit about, well, the mayor's second term rolling in now. He rolled in January with his State of the City address. January 30th, I believe, was the date of the State of the City address. And he was already dealing with some prickly issues, and those prickly issues seem to just continue to come in waves during this first couple of month and a half now. What's going on over there?
It's a good question. We've got a brand new police chief in Chief Tarasovic. My question about the chief is not how effective he's going to be. I've talked to people in the police department who've said, I'm hearing both sides of that story. I'm hearing he's a great guy. I'm hearing the other side as well. But what I'm concerned about is it just happened. There was no hiring process that the people were allowed to hear about or have any input in. I don't think the council had any input in it, and yet they are the ones who are going to put the money forward to pay the gentleman's salary. This is a different form of government I'm seeing. This is a machine-style form of government.
All right, so first off, Paul, is this the strong mayor government that you had outlined and that you were a champion of? Or is this a different animal?
Well, let's just look at the practicalities here. I think that Norwood cooked his goose when he dragged his feet, apparently.
And real quick, we're talking about, of course, Brian Norwood, who's the former chief of police.
I think he cooked his goose when he dragged his feet or those cops that made those offensive remarks about the president and the first lady. The mayor made it clear he wanted them gone quick. They weren't gone quick, and I think that's the end of it. Clearly, the mayor didn't have time to do any real search. I believe what the mayor told Norwood is, you're gone, I'll give you time to get a new job. But if you don't have it by a certain date, you're out of here.
Right.
And therefore, he canned Norwood and had to have someone to fill in real quickly. Instead of going intern, he went with this other gentleman. Perfectly in line with what we had anticipated with the elected mayor law.
So, Bruce, you can speak to this. You were there for a couple of these. Is the interim chief is not an unusual office in Richmond.
We've seen a couple of those. No, unfortunately, I think we've had quite a few police chiefs over the years, and it makes it tough for a police department to function over time. And I think it's unfortunate we're going through this. I've thought about this a lot in the sense that here you have a situation where you have a police chief who stepped in from Chief Monroe and has done a good job. And now we have this gamesmanship going on, and there are three outcomes that can happen. One, this gentleman steps in, makes all the difference in the world, and the crime rate drops, and he looks like a hero. The other is that everything stays the same, or it gets worse. And I've yet to figure out, two out of the three are bad. Why would you risk it? Why were you so emphatic about making sure he was gone? And I know Paul's mentioned what he thinks was the trigger. And I agree that was one piece of it. But there were lots of other things going on.
The chief of police at one point said in a Style article about a year and a half ago, I think it was, that we're not going to arrest our way out of the problem in Chaco Bottom. And the mayor in the same piece was quoted as saying, we have a zero tolerance policy. Well, there's a whole lot of ground between zero tolerance and we're not going to arrest our way out of the problem. I think one of the things that people need to look at is, is this police chief actually an interim? The other thing people need to look at is we are a majority African American city with a white fire chief and a white police chief now.
Well, let's go back to something. That's amazing.
I don't think that should really matter. Hold on, guys.
One at a time.
This could be fun tonight.
One at a time on this. You were saying, Bruce.
Well, first of all, I don't think race matters. I mean, if you look at the administration overall, you'll see that there have been very few white hires in this administration. So, you know, look at the big picture, and if you want to start pulling out the cards, and I think you'll realize that it's not been a balanced approach. But that's fine. I mean,
ding ding, Paul, your thought.
What's happening here is that the mayor is, you know, wants everybody to basically be part of the chorus, and he's putting his own people in everywhere to run everything he possibly can. He's got his own former aide running the school board. He's now got his own police chief, not Wilder's police chief. And I think if you go down the list, he's built up an extremely large staff. We have the most expensive city hall in anywhere in the state. It's really just an employment zone. And basically, this is what's happening. And so it just seems to me that what would you expect? They want to run the city as some kind of, you know what I call it? I always say Richmond is, you know, basically same plantation, different owners. And let's be honest about it. The public has been cut out over the years, is being cut out. Police chief, perfect example. I'm going to fire a guy, bring my old guy in. I'm not asking anybody.
Now, going back to something that Bruce had said there a little bit ago, this guy, our former chief, Brian Norwood, had maintained a pretty record low crime rate that had been established under Monroe, Rodney Monroe, who left under a little bit of a shadow of scandal himself with a fake degree. But there was some accomplishments. There were genuine accomplishments that were in place, and despite a bad economy, the crime rate had stayed low. And now we're bringing in this new person, and as Charlie had noted, I think earlier before the broadcast, and I don't know if you want to share this on air, but there's some issues with questions about that. I can talk to it. I'll speak to it. During the school board eviction, Tarasovic was the ground general for the removal of the school board from City Hall. I was nearly arrested along with two other reporters trying to attend a public meeting. There was a legal public meeting upstairs in City Hall, and Tarasovic ordered us to be arrested. So that's kind of an issue, and now you have them coming in, and so there are going to be some questions, I think, in a lot of people's minds. Who is this guy? What is his record? And what can he possibly bring, I guess, now is the question. He's got a record low crime rate. Where is there to go from here? And what does that do for the mayor if it goes up, even if it fluctuates a little up? What does that do for Mayor Jones?
I've spoken with several community leaders, not politicians, since the hire. And everybody is concerned that whatever little community involvement there was. I mean, when Monroe was here, you had massive community involvement in community policing. I mean, meetings would be held on Northside, and there would be literally hundreds of people in the room.
I remember.
Right. Okay. Now, we've lost some of that with this former chief. Are we going to get it back? Or, given the way the hire was made, is there even going to be even less? I should say, is there going to even be less community involvement? People want to be involved in this city, and they haven't been now.
Now, on the other hand, Tarasovic comes from the Monroe administration, was a close lieutenant of Monroe's. Maybe he was part of the secret ingredient, the secret sauce that got us where we are.
But haven't you sort of put your finger on it to some degree? You know, the mayor said one of the reasons he was getting rid of Norwood implied, well, we got to get the crime rate down or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that Monroe, Norwood, compared to what was before, I mean, it's we were once what the top one of the top 10 murder capitals of the world, and now hey, so what you have to see in this is I can't quite get the word out, but they're politicizing the police department. It's my understanding that they want possibility that they want more control over the public relations stuff that may be going out from the police department. You have a is part of what's going on. You know, the chloroform of conformity has drifted over this city, and they're just allowing stuff to go on. And it is, I think, symbolized by the school system. The only thing this administration and others seem to be able to do is figure out how to give it less money, reasons to give it less money. Lord knows there's reasons to give it less money in some areas. But we now have a school system, which is the number one thing the community is supposed to do, getting less money from the city of Richmond than any time since segregation. And in fact, the whole very poverty commission that he put out totally misconstrued how much money the city was given.
Bruce, you were on council for some of these budgets.
Let's back up and let me say a couple things about this change at the top leadership. Paul is absolutely correct. We have a bloated administration. It is, my best recollection, is about 25% higher than the comparable cities that the Bob report used. And when you walk through all the administration and walk through all of the departments and you use the Virginia statistical information that you can go out on the web and get, you will see Richmond, with the exception of Park and Recs, is anywhere from 17% higher over the median than any other, and it goes up to 300, and it is unbelievable.
How did we get there?
How did we get there?
Yeah.
Mismanagement. And again, last year the game plan was throw the schools under the bus, don't talk about what's really going on our side of the ledger, because we do have a bloated government, and let's make all the fuss over here. And as a result, we once again pushed the Richmond public schools down, made people going to Richmond public schools feel like they were second class or third class citizens. And the reality is that now we do the police chief thing. So once again, we've got the turmoil, and now we'll spend another budget and it'll go through. You know, one of the things I think about and hasn't been talked about in this room is the fact that when you talk to the rank and file and you just ask them what they thought of Chief Norwood, it was pretty positive.
Right.
You rarely got the negative comment. And a lot of them were saying, you know, the guy is looking out for us, and he's doing a lot of things. Now, what do we have? And you got to also remember that this police force and the fire department.
You're asking rhetorically,
yeah.
What do we have?
Yeah.
There's an uncertainty.
It's an uncertainty. Now, on top of that, we have a financial issue, which most people don't realize. Our funding for their retirement is at 58%. It is the lowest in the state or next to the lowest. We are asking them to go out and do this job, creating turmoil at the top and not supporting them with the dollars that are supposed to be there. And it's a mess. And the administration has avoided dealing with it by doing all these other things.
Now, we had another, right at the very head waters of this administration's second term issue, we'll call it an issue, with social services. And
don't get me started.
No, we'd like to get you started, actually.
And this was interesting. This was somebody who was very closely placed to the mayor. This was his deputy deputy city administrator, yeah. Carolyn Graham, who ends up leaving. I guess she resigned, but it was swift in the same way that this police chief removal was swift. There were things that were going on that did not look like they were great, and we have not yet seen the conclusion of that. I don't think we're going to see much more in the way of political outfall from it, but this was not. This had to have been embarrassing.
Well, it's like I said in the last show we did.
Administration.
It's like I said in the last show we did. And Paul, I think you probably recall this. That all happened right after the election. So it was easily swept, if you will. It was timed sort of perfectly, if you will, for the mayor to say, oh, look, that just happened. Oops. Now, look, the Redskins. Or here's something bigger. Or here's something else. Or, you know, nothing is – that was never really truly dealt with. And I'm hoping that this council will deal with it.
Now there brings another question in, is the council. So city council during the mayor's it was during the swearing-in ceremony for that new council. The mayor made some remarks that almost sounded like he expected this to be one big kumbaya, we are family sort of event.
Absolutely.
Well, he should. He set it up.
For 4 years. What sort of place does that put us in as a community without the you know, or maybe they'll develop into a check and a balance on this, but I mean, where are we right now with that sort of an attitude where the mayor is assuming we have that, Paul?
I put it on the public. You know, all these folks are getting elected. I think that in a democracy, the voters have to own up for the people they elect. And I look at it in a kind of a broader context, that it reflects what the people really want from the city or what they're willing to fight for. I think it's somewhat disingenuous for the public to sort of complain about, oh, look who we got, and it's not doing what we want, when you've elected them time and time again. You know, what do the people of Richmond want? And, of course, they're different communities. They really don't seem to want an excellent school system. Now, they can say they do. But, you know, the mayor was on the school system. He was on the board. We went to an elected board in 1994.
Former chairman of that board.
Okay. You know, you have the mayor says the school system's, you know, not functioning. But the superintendent and everybody else who supposedly is running the place, everybody's still there. Okay, the council complains about a lot of stuff, but the mayor expects them to be a rubber stamp, is what you're saying, and they don't really seem to be.
I don't know that I'm saying that, but.
Well, that's exactly what you were saying, and that's what he's saying. And the mayor wants a police chief. I put in a police chief. The Carolyn Graham thing, what that tells me is simply this. The public doesn't care about these kids. That's all. You can't really blame. First of all, she got fired, so she would get her severance. If she had resigned, she wouldn't get her severance, okay?
But, you know, it's funny. Norwood got a severance. Mm-hmm. He resigned and yet got a severance.
Well,
did you read that?
The difference is having been involved with that, you know, you can come to an agreement.
And his agreement, as I recall, was it had to
okay,
do
so
with
they had an MOU.
There was
mutual.
Probably
okay.
A contract.
Right, I didn't mean to interrupt.
But with Graham, you know, that she wanted to get fired. I mean, you ever hear someone wanted to get fired so she would get her sentence? But the fact is, we accept this. The fact is, nobody really cares about those kids. I mean, the files are now missing. Their files are missing. Nobody really cares. Let's be honest about it. You know, you had a poverty commission, and unfortunately, it's not here. If you read that report says that the only way really out for these children is education. Yet they could get the money that the city gets right. They said it was 150 some odd million. They were counting the money that the state gives that's put in there to make it look better. We're just not serious about what we want for change. We're satisfied with merely complaining. And so that's what you get.
There's an old saying, you know, people get the government they deserve.
I'm with Charlie Diridor, Paul Goldman, and also with Bruce Tyler. What I guess I'd like to ask here is in another city where you have these sorts of things, and the one we have not mentioned is Treegate over on Lee Street with the trees that were supposed to remain. These were large trees. These are old growth trees, hundreds of or 100 or more of them that were supposed to stay. That have been bulldozed, and there's now a clear-cut field over there, windswept. and it now appears that more was known by the administration about what was planned
surprise,
over there.
Surprise,
I love the first quote.
Well, let me
before
on.
You stop, yeah. Stop, I'm going to stop you right there, okay? Because the first quote was, oh, well, that wasn't the way it was supposed to be. And then not 2 days later, the next quote out of the mayor was, actually, the plans changed in October.
And then
so what's true? I mean, I want to know
true. What's true is the contractor followed the construction documents that he was given. So in order to for him to execute what he did, he had to have a plan drawn up by a civil engineer that basically said, this is to be removed.
Right, but I've talked to people on the Planning Commission who say, yeah, it was there, we just didn't look at it. I mean, this is part of the problem for this project.
But this project was
shoved
funny.
Down the throats of everybody.
In another city, or in this city, should we see council pursuing more aggressively answers?
Absolutely.
But
and
they won't.
And
well, wait a minute. Hold on. So you're a councilor, former councilman.
I mean,
why not?
Look, I can tell you right now, I sat on council, and it was always the next time. Always the next time. Oh, you don't do this ever again. Don't ever show up to a council meeting without giving us the proper information. We won't do a thing unless you give it to us in advance. And next thing you know, they show up again, and the same crowd rolls over again and again and again. Nothing is going to change with this. Nothing. Unless something really dramatically happens. Now, I'm going to go back to Paul's point about Richmond Public Schools in the sense that there's been more generated over trees than there have been about the Richmond Public Schools.
Very true.
And it is sad to think that there's more public outcry about losing 100 trees that probably, you know, it's natural state. Sorry they're gone, but at the end of the day, you know, no one's hurt, no one's injured. And yet we have thousands of children going into Richmond Public Schools. And oh, by the way, if you haven't been in some of those school buildings, you need to take a tour because it's embarrassing. Now, some of them are fine, and I'm very appreciative of what's going on with the school system in terms of the new schools. But at the end of the day, 90% of the kids are in buildings that have not been properly maintained because there's not a funding source known as city council and the mayor. I have tried to say to the city school board members recently, don't accept the number the mayor gives you or anyone else. Build your own budget. You have an obligation to take care of the children first, the city second.
But outcome-based budgeting doesn't allow for that.
No, that's what's happened is, and give the mayor credit, he's slick. You know,
we'll agree on that.
He's, Wilder came in, he'd been governor, so he could play the game at a pretty high level. The mayor was in the General Assembly for a while. Not a particularly active guy, but still, you pick up a lot of stuff. The mayor came in, and it's interesting the difference in the philosophy. Wilder's approach was, you know, I'm going to show that I'm tough on the money. So he really didn't care what the school system proposed. He was going to make his own proposal. And, hey, if they want to propose X, I'll make it X minus 10. I like that. All right? The mayor, entirely different approach. The mayor clearly went to Brandon and the school board and said, look, I don't want to be accused of not giving you the money you're asking for, all right? Because I don't like that politics. Now, we're going to agree on what I'm going to give you and then what you're going to ask for. And that's what happened except in this last round, okay? Now, if you look in the city charter and the state law,
well, now let me ask you something. Was that brave on the part of Brandon going ahead forward with a budget that – is she the unsung hero in this? She came forward with a budget that was
I'm not sure that – I think she's wanted to do what the mayor wanted, but these other folks didn't. But the point I'm trying to make –
You mean the other elected folks?
Well, you know, there isn't
a school – the people who represent the people.
The state law and the charter say that the school board is supposed to propose the budget it thinks is necessary to provide the quality of education they think the students of Richmond deserve. That's their job. However, if they do that, the mayor and the city council are going to say, hey, we ain't going to give you that much money. We're not even going to come close to that. the old school board decided to cave, except for went crazy at the end, right? I don't know what the new school board is going to do. But I can. What I'm sensing is that the city council and the mayor want to squeeze down more. They want to cut the city's contribution more. You know, it's one thing to know how to make something cheaper. You know, that ain't hard. Eric Cantor knows how to make things cheaper. But it's another thing to know how to make things better. And that's really the trick.
More
in
efficient
governing.
Is what you're saying.
Well, the thing is, yeah, there's some areas that need less money. But there's some areas that need more money. It's not supposed to be just we're only going to make it 17% of the budget and 15% of the total budget. They've reduced the city support and continue to reduce the city support to schools to level that haven't been seen since, you know, Plessy v. Ferguson. It just doesn't make any sense.
A good while ago, Plessy v. Ferguson.
A couple weeks ago, I believe.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a recent Supreme Court decision.
The flip side of this thing is that in their success stories in Richmond Public Schools, I can tell you right now, if we doubled the size of Mary Mumford, they would fill it with parents who want their children to be there.
Why does it have to be one building, though, I think?
It comes down to the excellence that principal put in place with the teachers he's brought in and the involvement of the parents. And Paul had a son there.
Yeah.
So he knows firsthand. I've watched it as a councilman, and I've watched someone take the schools and build what he had with what he was given and hire people who are just as dedicated as he was and is. And today, you know, 95% of the people in that school are in zone public schools. You can't get in that school if you're out of zone. And it's one school at a time. But I'm telling you, there's opportunities there for this Richmond Public Schools to shine and grow. And let's face it, you know, and I'll say it again, you can't have a tier one city unless you have a tier one school system. It's that simple.
Now, we're about out of time, guys, but I guess just to finish up here, we have some of these things that are questionable events, occasions that have beset our administration. Do they really matter? I mean, are things running relatively smoothly? Are things getting
Everything
done?
Matters.
Everything matters.
And that's what you know, Paul talks about the chloroform of conformity, and I think he's exactly right. I think a pall has been cast over this city where people say, you know what, it's never going to change. It's Richmond is Richmond.
But aren't things moving forward? We're getting Redskins. We're probably going to get
that
a
depends
new
on, again, that depends on whether you consider the Redskins moving forward or not. I don't consider it, because what happens 7 years from now when Dan Snyder makes another deal in Pennsylvania and moves the Redskins? And what are we left with?
Moving forward is really very simple. When our children can get the education they need to basically go out and live the life they want to live, that's when Richmond will be moving forward. Redskin deal is just a blip. It's not going to last. And it'll be a part of the history of Richmond, and that's the end of the conversation. But the lasting conversations begin with us dealing with making sure we educate our children properly and give them the support systems they need to succeed.
Paul, you're going to get the short last word.
You know, moving forward depends on, you know, what direction you want to go in. If education is the number one job, which I think Bruce is correct on, you know, it's not gone in the right direction. I'm sorry. I mean, not only do we have the oldest schools in the state, but, you know, last year, I had a little dialogue with the state of Virginia and forced them to change their website. They used to say that you got a high school education in Virginia made you college ready, including Richmond. They took that off because it isn't true. We are actually going backwards on education. We're 20th in the world.
Now, that's not Richmond. Just to be clear, that's nationally. We're 20th in the world. So that sounds like another issue of open source where we'll have you guys back. Again, I've been speaking with Charlie Deardor. He's a local businessman now blogging about the city at rvareport.com. Bruce Tyler, he's a former city councilman, a rare duck, a city Republican, and he's also a principal at Baskerville Architecture Engineers and Interior Designers. And Paul Goldman. Paul Goldman, he's former chairman of the Virginia Democratic Party and a contributor at Fox News and Politico. And Charlie's waving either goodbye or one more thing.
I've got one tease for you.
Why did I know?
I've got one tease for you.
Go for it.
Major member of the mayor's staff has committed to coming on this show.
Excellent.
David Hicks.
Can't wait.
Saw him today.
And we'll have him on very
soon.
Can't
wait for it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Forget all the syrupy Chamber of Commerce hoo-ha about Richmond being a vibrant, livable city filled with soul-affirming amenities and creative people living their dreams. Richmond is actually a pit of death and decay and unspeakable terrors hiding in wait in dark places. And we've got plenty of dark places. At least that's the greater metro area showcased in Richmond Macabre 2, a new anthology of short stories. The book's a sequel to the original volume published 2 years ago. And it again sees local authors contributing nightmarish tales of vengeful spirits, ravenous zombies, macabre fiends, and general creepiness, each with River City serving as the evocative backdrop. Phil Ford and Beth Brown are the editors behind both volumes of Richmond Macabre. Beth knows a little bit about Richmond's darker side, having written several books on local paranormal legends. And Phil Ford is a writer, musician, and DJ. You can listen to him right here on WRIR every Friday at 6 a.m. on the Breakfast Blend. And he also sits on the board of the Center for the Public Press. So the first collection of stories came out in 2011. This one is slimmer, but no less macabre. Did you not get the submissions that you wanted? Or
I think we got the submissions. We just scaled back more, right?
We were much choosier this time. Mm-hmm. The material was so good, and we really only wanted to pick the top entries. And if that meant that we had to cut a few more people, we felt it gave a better product in the end.
And the first book was more an open call to just kind of celebrate the idea, I think, of Richmond macabre and horror, and that there are stories to tell in fiction about Richmond. And so we kind of had the door a little wider open. And this time, since it's kind of established or it was a kind of established book this go round, that we would tighten it up a little bit, like Beth said.
So. Yeah, I see some familiar names from the previous book, but there's also some new writers on board. How did you find this batch of 11?
They find us. Yeah. It's amazing. We hang out a sign and we say that we want stories. And miraculously, these things show up in an inbox. But that's the blessing, I guess, of doing this now compared to doing this 30 years ago when you're sorting through the mail. With the first volume, we tried every approach known to man, from posters on billboards to Craigslist, of all things, which is sort of a horror story in itself. But this time, we put the call out through the richmondmacabre.com website and then through Facebook. And word of mouth, it just spread quickly. All of the writers' groups in the area had heard of the first volume, mm-hmm. and they were quick to jump on board when we had the second call.
And what were y'all looking for when you were evaluating? What's the, I don't know, what's the protocol? What are you specifically looking for, horror or?
I think, well, I guess as far as content, well, first of all, and Beth will talk about the rules, I'm sure, but I think content, we were really looking for Richmond-based horror stories, mm-hmm. and they could be anyway, even if it had any type of horror, it could be zombie horror, or it could be just kind of a weird Bradbury kind of mm-hmm. style mm-hmm. horror, or even just kind of a sense of dread and, right. And darkness, like with the first story. So
yeah, what I like about the collection is the kind of the wide range mm-hmm. of different types of stories. Julie Gein's story about the West End lady who's adapting well in the zombie world.
Damn horseshoes.
And right. Sarah Vogelsong's story was really, really touching. And then there's Dale Brumfield. And
the man has
Strange Tale of Chicken.
The sickest imagination of any author in Richmond, for sure. And it knows no bounds.
Careful, he'll blurb that.
I told him that before. He seemed rather proud.
Yeah.
Now, I think as far as quality of story, how we really whittled down the selections, we looked for anything that after we read it made us say, man, that was cool, or mm-hmm. something that gives you goosebumps, truly gives you goosebumps, and shows the city in a way that maybe you wouldn't normally think about it, which Dale Brumfield certainly yeah. does that.
Or maybe the way that you do feel about it. I mean, one thing that the writers have is they have this incredible setting that they can work with. Mm-hmm. Talk about that, Beth. You've done a lot of research on the supernatural in the area. What is it about Richmond that makes it such a great setting for a horror story?
Oh, anything goes here. And that's I was lucky enough to pen the introduction for the second volume, and that was the focus of my intro, was the contrasts here. Mm-hmm. We have such a wide variety of what is classified as normal, which it didn't strike me as odd until I went to the West Coast, and I talked about some of these things from back home when people looked at me like I just dropped from outer space. When you live in a city full of contrasts like this, any sort of bizarre story has a grain of truth somewhere in it, and that's what makes them so spooky. They get under your skin because you never know. Is this true? Is this based on true events? Is this just from somebody's twisted imagination? Right. Richmond is perfect for that. And we have so many tales and legends here that do have roots in history. These can be supported by fact mm-hmm. that it just gives the stories that much more credence.
Yeah, a lot of these are touched upon Richmond Vampire at Hollywood Cemetery and things like that. A lot of the writers take things that we think we know or legends and kind of go crazy with them, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some, as like to go on what Beth was saying, it's like there's always an element of truth I think that these stories came out with, that there's a hint of believability if you're willing to go there. And I think that some of these people did research for their stories in order to, you know, like Sarah Vogelsong's story is based probably on a real house and a real incident mm-hmm, that happened. Mm-hmm. And all the locations, I think that was another thing that we were looking for in the stories, or at least I was a sense of, wow, I know where this is, or I get a feel for where this place is. And there was a surprising amount of stories that we did receive for this one that we didn't accept, that were kind of like they were Googled. You know, so it's just like insert, oh, look, there's the whatever building here, you know, that they just went down the street map. But I think the ones here particularly just really, you really get an essence of what Richmond is kind of about.
Mm-hmm. You guys have written for these as well. Beth, you had a story in the first volume, and mm-hmm. Phil has written stories in both. Talk a little bit about the challenge of editing this kind of project while you're also a contributor.
It helps that there are two of us because, you know,
well, yeah.
editing your own work, you know, you miss a lot of things and you don't see the weak points in the story that someone else might see. So fortunately, we had each other to bounce those off of. It's tough. I'll just say that. I did not write a contribution for the second volume. I didn't write a short story for it by choice.
Because, you did do the intro, though.
Right. But I wanted to be able to devote all of my editorial attention this time to the fiction instead of having to worry about my own story. And hopefully Phil was thankful for that.
Oh, no. I loved your – I liked the first story in the first book. Because it was an homage to the Poe.
It was Poe. You know, yeah. Right? It drew upon the Poe, all the stuff that we love about that.
I just like the idea of being able to get a story in there because I always kind of have something weird going on in my head that's Richmond based and I think that that you know I did the vampire in the first one and then I did just a random one of a giant in this one but I wanted to use history as a kind of a platform for that. And having it happen during Gabriel's rebellion kind of really kind of made it – it's like when you get a story like that, it's like, man, that sounds really cool. And that's really, really Richmond-y. And boy, where else would this go but into something like this? And thankfully, Beth did make some suggestions, but she wasn't too harsh on me.
Oh, I'm not as mean as the critics make me out to be.
Well, talk a little bit about those guidelines. Obviously, you set people up with how many words they could use.
Three to 6,000, I think, and then content is.
Did you impose setting on them? Did you say we would really like a story on blank?
No, we left it wide open. We just required that it be set in Richmond. It's any time period of the author's choosing, any setting, and we were even loose. It didn't have to be Richmond proper. We were
Greater Richmond area.
Henrico, Chesterfield. We had some folks that asked about the outskirts. I guess they're not really that far out anymore, but. So it was flexible. The only thing that we were really stringent on was the word count, and that is just so we didn't have one story overpower the rest or vice versa, one that gets swallowed up by these massive stories that are three times in length. So we just asked that they kept them between 3,000 and 6,000 words, and most everybody followed the guidelines.
Mm-hmm. And I think and as far as like short story collections, if you get any larger than, say, well, I mean, we kind of kept it at a pretty good balance. But if you get any larger, you're talking novella. Mm-hmm. And I think especially with horror short stories, and it's so geographically based that you – unless you're writing a novel like The Reservoir or you're doing something else that's bigger in scope, a short horror fiction, it doesn't need to be but so long because otherwise I think you're going to lose the reader in a collection, you know, because sometimes you just want to get – it's like, dang, that was a really good story.
Right.
And it's all tight and shiny or it's loose and weird at the end. But then it's like, well, what's next? You know, what's the next one going to do? And
yes. I think – short attention spans.
Right.
We're the generation of remote controls.
So it's perfect for today's generation.
Certainly.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things that I liked about it, in fact, like about short stories. When you want them to keep going, but yet, you know, they've ended. And
I know. I mean, like Shirley Jackson's great for that and everything. And yeah. It's just you kind of leaves you hunger, you know, like a little appetite still left over. So.
Talk about some of your favorite stories in this new volume of Richmond Macabre. Richmond Macabre 2, it's more
Nightmares
from the River City.
Well, can we talk about the cover?
Yes, please. Yeah, who did the cover? It's very EC Comics.
Right? I like that.
Tales from the Crypt, right?
We wanted this to have a different feel on the outside than the first volume. The first volume was very historical. It was Noah Scalin's paper cutting, very formal, very Richmond. We wanted to show the other side of the city, that loose skateboard, PBR.
Sequel,
you know,
kind of like, you know.
Dirty alleys is what we said when we asked for the cover work. So we went to James Callahan from Barf Comics, and he's widely known around Richmond for his fabulous skateboards and his fine art, but gave us exactly what we were looking for, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think I've even seen the guy because we've dealt with through email, which is great. He's such a nice guy from the email, and he gave us exactly what we wanted, I think. He gave us a few sketches, and what's brilliant is just the colors are so, like, vibrant and poppy, and then in the back, it's just more of the same, and it kind of has this whole sequel vibe to it. That
B-movie horror.
B-movie horror. Yeah, that's what we were going for.
Drive-in horror is what we wanted.
Is this going to continue? Will there be a third volume of Richmond Macabre? It seems like you got a franchise here.
Well, I'll tell you before Beth chimes in, I guess, is that when we did the first one, and Beth and I would sit down in a meeting, and it would be like, my dream, like the dream to me would be like, we do 10 of them, you know, and then at five, we do this special
bound volume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, of course, it's completely self-serving in that I would have a short story in every time if I could. And then I'd have a collection of short stories. But I think more importantly was just, you know, after the first one, I was just kind of like, okay, that was great, you know. And if Beth wants to do one, I'm always there because she knows where I'm at with it. So, but well, we're both very busy too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a disclaimer, Richmond Macabre, the first volume, was our first time doing an anthology, either one of us, assembling it, writing for one, whatever. So we learned a lot in the process that benefited us for the second volume, but we also learned a lot through the second volume how things maybe don't always go as you hope or plan. So if we can take those two sets of lessons together and knock out a third volume, it might be gravy this time. I don't
know. Right.
We're optimistic. I'm optimistic. I'm not going to speak for Phil. But,
you might be due. You might be due.
I really enjoy working with Beth, and I think we kind of have this kind of level of working a relationship that's really good. I
mean, she's making faces at you.
No, it's just, you know, we kind of understand each other, and it's great working with her. So yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic as well, but I think it's a matter of timing and how we're going to do it and stuff.
Right.
So it's a great project, I think.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's one of those projects where I'm just, you know, you're still thinking about places where you haven't set stories,
time periods,
these macabre incidents.
Did you notice there seems to be more older ones setting this time around too?
I did notice that, notice too that in the first volume, Michael Gray Bond's story was the one that really stood out as the story of the past. Mm-hmm. And many, many critics have praised his story specifically. And I think that a lot of folks who contributed to the second volume were very inspired by him. And
a little bit about him. What is his background? I enjoyed those too, and I didn't know anything about it. Y'all know?
He edits. He's an editor himself, I believe.
And he's written many nonfiction books for young readers. Mm-hmm. And I think that writing short stories is something that he does for the pure enjoyment of it.
Right.
It shows. I mean, you can tell that he has a good time.
Because it's great. Great
his stories are very alive. And in the second volume here, he's gone completely opposite and set something in modern day using modern technology. And it's every bit as spooky and surreal as his contribution to the first volume.
His story in this one called The Analog is really reminds me of some Japanese horror fiction, Koji Suzuki particularly, because Koji Suzuki did the Ring series, you're familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were novels first. So his his whole attitude and tone in that one is just very much like a 360 and that really shows how talented, you know, he is and being able to write in so many different time periods and styles.
Where can people get the book? It's out now in bookstores, I'm guessing. Where can people find out more information and actually go out and purchase it?
Chop Suey is where we did our book launch, and so they have both of the volumes there, and they are available. Local bookstores such as
Fountain Books,
Has it.
And I noticed you can get them online too, if that's your preference.
There.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. And we also have the ebook available. I guess is how you call it, an ebook.
Yeah, the folks who prefer to read on their phones with or their tablets can grab it for Kindle. But we do hope that you will go through one of the local retailers to pick up a copy, because it's a local project. We really want to keep it community focused, and what better way to do that than actually going out and seeing somebody who lives in your city who's happy to sell you a copy of this book.
And they're real
city.
Friendly too, the folk there at these bookstores. So.
And you've also got a richmondmacabre.com also?
Yes.
Great. Well, we've been
we also have a Facebook page too, so if you want to. I hate to say that, but that's
like
a good social.
Like us on Facebook.
Well, no, you have to be liked.
You can do that.
You want to keep
they
up
like
with the
me.
Events,
they
like us on Facebook.
Right, because the events will pop up there if they're going to show up. So.
Any upcoming events that we can preview?
No.
No, none in the works. We're going to hang on to them for when people are thinking spooky.
Right.
So you're going to see more of us over the late summer, early fall, I'm sure.
A really slow build.
In time for the harvest.
Oh.
And who knows, maybe another call for entries.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned, as they say. We've been talking with Beth Brown and Phil Ford. They're the editors of Richmond Macabre 2, More Nightmares from the River City. It's another anthology of hair-raising horror stories set in Richmond. The book is out now, and you can find out more by going to richmondmacabre.com. Hey, and you can also listen to Phil on WRIR. I see you guys. You can also listen to Phil on WRIR each and every Friday at 6 a.m. on the Breakfast Blend, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're also a member of the board of the Center for the Public Press.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, January 15th. As always, thanks for taking the time to join us. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Amy Daniel and Don Harrison. And our producers are Gabby Schatzi and Jay Westerman. Jay is away this week answering his people's call of Ponfar. Ah, space age romance. Our board op is the lovely and mysterious Mannion. Hey, we love comments, questions, and news tips, and we want to hear from you. This is, after all, your show. Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com and then like us on Facebook at opensourcerva. In the doghouse because you forgot to get your honey something special for Valentine's Day? We highly recommend Saying I Love You a little late by filling your beloved or betrothed or just besotted's iPod or Android device with this and past episodes of Open Source RVA, available in convenient and romantic podcast form at our website, rvaopensource.com. We'll be back next week.